You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Can I just say I violently disagree with that, because this is, you may say, oh, it's not a crisis situation, but you know, we have long-term unemployment is continuing to rise. People's savings are being exhausted. Young people are facing the prospect of graduating from college into a dismal labor market, and we know from a lot of evidence that that will destroy their earnings prospects, not just for a year or two, but for decades. So to say, well, let's wait, we're pretty sure that we're not going to get a really good bounce out of what's left in the stimulus. The peak impact on the economy's growth rate is probably already behind us. To say, well, let's just wait and see, that's easy to say if you've got a job, if you're a person well-established in his life's career. But we're suffering enormous harm to the nation's future by not acting now.
What about that?
Well, I am concerned about unemployment. But keep in mind that the original stimulus program that Obama's advisors always said would have its peak impact 8 quarters after its enactment. So they themselves always said that the money was going to have its most important impact next year. And a lot of the stuff that has high impact is things like public works programs, which the president would fund some more of. But it's not clear to me that there's worthwhile things out there to be funded that aren't already being funded, you know?
There's tons. We know that the stimulus originally was lowballed. It was below what even the administration's own economists thought was appropriate. We now have, I don't know what they were saying then, but what they say now is that the peak impact on jobs is about the middle of this coming year. That there's a widespread fear. A lot of people, you know, independent business economists, are worried that as the stimulus fades out, we may be heading for a renewed recession, a double dip. So this is time is wasting. If we sit and don't do anything, we could be facing a very, very nasty economy by the time we finally get around to doing something.
You don't agree with that?
Well, I don't think there's a consensus by any means that we're going into a double dip or anything like that. The last time I checked the consensus forecast, where economists were looking at 2.7% real growth next year, which is pretty good. And one of the things that concerns me is the idea that the administration always said the stimulus is going to take care of itself as far as the budget is concerned. And if we make these things kind of semi-permanent, I worry about the deficit.
Paul Krugman, let me come back to you on this price tag for this jobs plan. As I mentioned earlier, the Associated Press threw out a number of maybe $170 billion, roughly matching what Congress is considering. If that's how much money it is, and if it is what the president described today, infrastructure spending, tax credits for small businesses, what do you think?
Well, it's way short of what I would like to see. I mean, if I could do it, if I thought it could be passed through Congress, I would call for much more. I mean, we are looking, Bruce mentioned consensus forecasts. Basically, almost everyone is expecting unemployment to remain at levels that we would have considered totally disastrous, unacceptable, not just through next year, but for several years to come. We're looking at a really depressed economy. The kind of number that, if it really is $170 billion, you know, they're doing some stuff that might give a fairly big bang for the buck in job creation, but it's still going to leave unemployment almost surely above 8%. At the end of next year, almost surely above 7% at the end of 2011. Those are not things we should be accepting. We should be not saying, well, that's all we can do. We've got some arbitrary limit set by congressional notions of what's responsible. And we're just not doing enough. I mean, I'm much more heartened at $170 billion than at some of the numbers I'd heard earlier this afternoon, which may or may not have been right. But it's not nearly big enough.
And Bruce Bartlett, finally, if you had to put a price tag on what you think the government should do, what would it be?
And
what?
Well, I, as I said before, I think we've done enough, and we ought to wait and see what happens. I just don't think that the case for rushing forward in a crisis situation with a lot of more money right now is quite justified. I think we can wait a little while, a couple of months.
Bruce Bartlett, Paul Krugman, gentlemen, thank you both.
Always good to have a good fight. Bruce Bartlett versus Paul Krugman that you heard. I don't know who won. Bruce Bartlett, I know personally. I don't know Paul Krugman as well. But someone that I do know who has written probably one of the essential books for you to read, entitled The Jewish Phenomenon. We first became acquainted about 7 years ago, right outside of Philadelphia, but it gives me great pleasure to to bring on Stephen Silberger, author of The Jewish Phenomenon. Stephen, are you there?
I am here. Stephen, thanks for inviting me.
Man, loud and clear. 7 years. You think that's long enough for us?
Hey, the book is still selling. People are still interested. So the publisher was kind enough to say, hey, let's revise this. Let's update it with new information. And I did that, putting it out. It came out this November.
Well, congratulations. And I think it's a classic. And as you know, I told you the story years ago, the hoops that we had to go through. I think we were passed along to about four or five different people before we were able to order the book 7 years ago. So now no one has to go through what we did. But I have to say this up front, Steve, that there's a handful of interviews that I've done at BlackElectorate.com over the years, and yours stands out as one of those that was the most intriguing, the most stimulating. It gets feedback over time. So congratulations on what you presented, because it certainly resonated with the viewers and listeners of BlackElectorate.com.
Yes, well, thank you. And I know, you know, through your website is reached the black community. I mean, other than the Jewish community has supported the book, I think the most embrace of the book has been from the black community. Last year, I was invited to the New Birth Baptist Church in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed. There were about 400 people. They had me speak. I attended a service. I spoke about the book for an hour and a half, and the pastor who had heard about the book thought it was had an important message, and it was best delivered from somebody outside the community, and it was a wonderful night. That was Bishop Victor Curry.
And that was in Miami?
That was in Miami.
Okay, well, let's start this conversation off right. Tell me, what is the difference, any revisions or additions from the original Jewish Phenomenon, and what the revised edition is?
Okay. Well, because there's a list of, you know, famous people in there, you know, I updated that, like the new Forbes 400 of, you know, prominent Jewish members. I updated that. Since, you know, I wrote the book in the year 2000, we had the two founders of Google, Facebook, the president of Microsoft, who are all Jewish, and now are new members of the Forbes 400. And those have been updated. And then throughout the book, there's updated, you know, information about, you know, new companies that have come up and other companies that have done poorly. And, of course, Bernie Madoff. And a lot of water has come on, you know, flown under the bridge.
Well, Steve, if I could, let me just give a little bit of your background now. Some people may actually know you from a more famous book, The 10-Day MBA. You are the author of that. I was surprised when I learned that. The 10-Day MBA. How many copies has that sold now worldwide?
Around 400,000.
Wow, because it was 200,000 about 7-8 years ago. So
yeah, I mean, it's like an annuity. You know, there's always new people interested in going back to school, and I had revised that book in 2005, and people always want to learn, you know, what they're teaching at business school, and that's what that book does. It's like the cliff notes to a business school education.
Have you noticed an uptick in that since the recession and all of these changes to grad education for business?
I really haven't. It's pretty steady. It sells in the United States between, you know, 15 and 20,000 copies a year, and then the outside is also equally popular. So It's as you would say, it's a blessing.
Well, let me ask you to outline again for those who are not familiar. What are the seven keys that you use as the framework of the Jewish phenomenon? And then I wanted to talk a little bit more about Jewish culture and history.
Okay, sure. Well, the seven keys is the first one. It's kind of obvious. Understand that real wealth is portable. It's knowledge. It's a respect for education. Get a good education. Number two, take care of your own and they'll take care of you. That would be taking care of your own community, nurturing it, and supporting it in many ways. Number three is successful people are professional and entrepreneurs. So when you look at who is successful in your community and who do you aspire to? Well, you aspire to be a professional or an entrepreneur, and that has many ramifications. Number four is develop your verbal self-confidence so that if you need something, you want something, you want to promote something, I mean, you can speak up. It's very important. Number five, be selectively extravagant and prudently frugal. What I mean by that is that you want to have a few things that you really are into and you're willing to spend the top dollar, But overall, you're pretty frugal because you want to save your money. Number six is take pride in individuality and encourage creativity. And number seven is be psychologically driven to prove something to yourself, to your parents, to your community. It's just kind of like a drive to succeed.
Now,
and that's the seven.
Well, thank you. I'm not going to ask you whether you read that or memorized it.
No, I looked at. That's right. I looked at. You know, I have the book here, so I was reading them, but also adding a little bit to it.
Well, I have joined the ranks of authors with my book, The Entrepreneurial Secret. And if it is in front of me, I will read from it. So no problem there. Now, let me ask you to make a correlation between those seven keys that are not necessarily the domain or monopoly of the Jewish community, as you made clear. But what is their origin or their foundation in Jewish culture or religious belief?
Well, like, for instance, the Jewish culture and the religion involves understanding your religion, studying your religion, questioning your religion, debating your religion. And that would be, you know, the first one about the reverence for getting a great education, that knowledge isn't, as a goal in unto itself, is valuable. Taking care of your own. The Jewish community has always been on the margins throughout the ages or persecuted, so we've tried to take care of our own. And also because, you know, Jews have been excluded over the centuries, they've become entrepreneurs because they weren't hired by other companies or big companies. They had to start their own companies, and if they weren't allowed to work at the banks, large banks, they created investment banking. If they weren't allowed to be part of the big law firms, they created their own law firms. And then the other side of it would be, you know, doctors. You know, they have their own thing, shopkeepers, peddlers, that type of thing. It's always been ingrained in the culture to be your own person, your own boss.
Okay, now, if you could, and I think this is probably the best way to do it so people will understand, because I want to get to some other points.
Sure.
What is the chain of events or the order in immigration patterns from the Jewish community around the world into America? So I know there's, you know, Jews from Eastern Europe, those from other parts. Could you, I don't want to, you know, labor you with a long history lesson, but you could take your time. What is the order of who came when and where they went and what maybe business or trade they specialized in?
Well, at the very beginning, you know, there were Jewish people here in very small numbers, you know, from the New Amsterdam times. But the real waves of Jewish immigration occurred in the 1800s. Those people came from mostly Western Europe. They were professionals. They were shopkeepers, that type of thing. And some of them were very, very poor. Then the second wave, large wave, came at the turn of the century, and most of those were Eastern Europeans with different type of culture. And some of those were just plain peasants, but a lot of them were, you know, trying to get an education. Many of them were independent professionals, shopkeepers, entrepreneurs, that type of thing. And then that was the huge wave that came through after World War II was the third large wave, and that was a mix of all kinds of Jewish people right around World War II as they were being running away from Nazis in 1938, 39, and 40. And then the next wave, which were really pretty small, that would be exodus of Russian Jews. That would be like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And that's pretty much it. You know, the Jewish populations actually decreased in size over the last decade since we spoke.
Now, thank you for laying that out. And let me, because that's very important, because non-Jewish individuals, as is normal with anyone that's maybe an outsider, don't think of the Jewish community as nuanced in terms of there's an inner different points of view on who's an Orthodox Jew. You know, all of that goes on in Israel, and then people don't even understand the difference between Israelis in Israel and Jewish members of the American country. So this is very layered. But as it relates to economics, would you be able to tell us who specialized in what out of those groups that came? Is that a little too complicated?
That would be a little complicated off the top of my head. But what you are kind of touching on is the the immigrants that came in the 1800s were mostly Western European, and those people assimilated very well. They were cultured, they were educated, and what have you. Then at the turn of the century, there were large waves from Eastern Europe, and these people, some of them very, you know, some of them were poorly educated, had more peasant ways, and it was incumbent on the community that was here to take care of that other community, even though sometimes they were embarrassed, kind of like the poor cousins coming to town. And there was a huge movement and a huge fundraising to assimilate those people as soon as possible. So that was like taking care of your own, because they'll take care of you.
Okay, wonderful. Now, to what degree do you credit the religion, what most people call Judaism, or the study of the Torah, and others would say the Talmud? To what, how much of the credit do these institutions deserve for what you call the Jewish phenomenon? Or would you say, Stephen, that in some respects the Chinese have been exemplary in some of these principles through their great economic success? How much of this is religious? How much of it is cultural? Is there a way to divide a line?
I think it's a mix, but the religion has a lot to do with it. The whole idea that being an outsider, being forced in different areas where other people aren't, as I kind of alluded to, when you have this religion, which there's only, you know, 6 million Jews in the, you know, 6 million Jews in the United States and 13 million overall, it's a small minority. So that idea that you're a very small group that has this single religion is important. The religion itself of, you know, believing in one God, studying the religion, being persecuted because you've kept this religion throughout the ages, has, you know, had a binding cohesion to the group, as well as the, as I said, the different professions, the different things that people have gone into because they've been forced to. If the whole world would be Jewish or as large as Christianity, you'd have so many different occupations. There would be a large breadth of Jewish endeavor, but since they've been forced into different areas, the success and monetary success is by creating extraordinary things and developing new opportunities. And I think the religion has a lot to do with it, but the culture that's developed around that is very important as well.
Now let me read you something from a work, because I mentioned China. Because there's a good body of literature that talks about the ethnic trading networks, Chinese culture. In some respects, the Jewish and Chinese communities have been exemplary in their ability to conduct economic activity across borders.
Right.
So there's this what we call a diaspora, which in Greek means scattering. There's been this scattering and dispersal of Africans, Jewish people. There's a lot of different diasporas, but the Chinese and the Jewish additions, I would say, have some economic success that maybe others have not enjoyed in the same way. But I wanted to read you something from a book you may be familiar with. It's written by Murray Schumach. It's called Diamond People. And this is from the footnotes of a book that I have called History, the Human Gamble, from a friend of mine, Reuven Brenner. He writes that Murray Schumach in Diamond People describes the mainly Jewish New York-based diamond industry of the 20th century. And it shows how social and religious bonds diminish uncertainty. And when he says uncertainty, he means the likelihood that a contract would be broken. So he says, exchange is based on complex rules that go back 1,000 years, and contracts are still based on a code of honor that traces its roots to the Old Testament, the Talmud, and the teachings of, is it Maimonides?
Mm-hmm.
Contracts of millions of dollars are concluded by only a handshake and the Hebrew Yiddish mazel and bruka, which means luck and blessing. Did I say that right, Stephen?
Yeah, pretty close.
So rather than being written...
Mazel and Brucha, yeah.
Yeah, one more time, Stephen.
Mazel and Brucha, yeah.
Okay, we'll work on it. Luck and blessing.
Sure.
Rather than being written, in some degree of hostility exists as it relates between religious and non-religious Jews. But scratching that last point, is that accurate? Are there certain trades where the trust level is so high in the Jewish community that contracts or the use of them are minimized and you can have something like that take place?
Oh, absolutely. You know, obviously the jewelry and diamond business is a very tight-knit, you know, industry. And everything doesn't have to be put down in writing to contract. But as the years go by and business becomes more complex and lawyers make our lives more hellish, a lot of that is going by the wayside and everything's being put into writing.
Very well. Now, I have a big hip-hop audience, as you know, a big music industry audience. And one of the things that I saw, and I've mentioned this to you before, is the relationship between young blacks and young Jews in the music industry. I was with Wu-Tang Clan. We had a Jewish lawyer, and this was, you know, right, quite common. And you would find a lot of the young record label owners were young Jewish gentlemen who may have grown up in either Florida or California or New York. And there was a certain level of camaraderie and respect. There was some tension and skepticism, and you had some of the, I would say, tension that existed between the previous generation of blacks and Jews. But to some degree, there was more of a cultural affinity through the music, which was very interesting. So I wanted to ask you, though, I interviewed Russell Simmons, and he describes the relationship that he had with members of the Jewish community, and he made a distinction between the Syrian Jews, as he called them, and others. So let me, I don't want to bore you, but I want to give context. Let me read this to you.
Sure.
What he said in our interview. He said that, this is what Russell says. He says, when I grew up, I was bused to a Jewish school, and I didn't know why the WASPs, that's the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, would chase me into this one particular area of the projects. At least that is what I thought they were, projects, and I didn't know why this one group of white people were chasing me and this other group was protecting me. But it was because I was a Jewish co-op, and he laughs. So he says, I have a relationship with them. One of my partners in the bags and belts and leather and underwear business and all of that is Jewish, and the Syrian Jews, I deal with a lot of them as Orthodox and others, so I really have an understanding of them. So then I asked him, is the well-known partner that he has, Lior Cohen, a member of that? So I say, is that the segment of the Jewish community that Lior Cohen, who was the president and CEO of Island Def Jam Music Group, is that the segment that he comes from? And Russell says to me, he says, no, Lior is Israeli. See, I understand the difference and the subtleties in the Jewish faith in terms of who is what and where they come from and what they believe a lot more than anybody else I know. They don't know the Syrian community like I know the Syrian community, like how and where they own every store in the ghetto. And all people are furious about these Jews owning all the stores, you know. So he says, but they, talking about the Syrian Jews, he said, they bought what the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants didn't want. And these Syrians, by the way, would never marry a Jew from outside. They only marry among themselves, their own kind of Jewish person. If they marry outside, they have to leave. Now, I could go on with more. I want to make another point. But
sure,
what do you think of that? And I could see some of the principles in your book at work, and also why there may be tension between the black community, Jewish community, as it relates to economics, et cetera. What do you think?
Well, I think, like, for instance, you know, I have family members that are Israeli and friends are Israeli, and, you know, that is a very secular society. And it's from this is my own personal observation, is that living in a country that's under constant threat of war makes people extremely aggressive for their, and I don't know if it's anxious or what have you, and
uneasy, insecure.
Excuse me?
Would you say uneasy or insecure?
Yeah. And when they come to the United States, where it's a very secure society, so to speak, that aggressiveness and that insecurity has propelled those people to be extremely successful in business here. And you can tell, like, it's almost, I have some relatives that we were talking about, I said, these Israelis are really, you know, very aggressive. And they really are. And I think it's just the nature of coming from a society over there that they're under the gun.
Okay, so now let's bring that to your book. Mm-hmm. And maybe why there is some suspicion or some just hesitancy from some members of the Jewish community about what you've done. We talked about this last time, but
right,
what do you think is at the root of some of the resistance that you have gotten from members of the Jewish community about this book that you've written?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, when this book was written, we were all gung-ho to be promoting it to the Jewish community and other communities, and we thought it would be embraced because this is a celebration of a community. This is the reason why that it is successful. This is, it has a lot of famous Jews, almost like a Jew Who book of all these famous Jewish people in all these different areas, from comic books, writers, musicians, business people, what have you. And we thought it would be embraced, but what it really turned out to be is it was shunned because they didn't want to bring the spotlight, and it's a laser focus here, of all the success for fear of anti-Semitism. And so they'd rather have the book die on the vine than to be very popular. And so what we found out was when I spoke to a Jewish community center or to a congregation, they were very receptive as I explained the book and what it's all about. And people were very excited about it. But when it came to the Jewish press and book reviewers, it was really politically incorrect to be talking about the subjects of Jewish success in America. And if you notice when Bernie Madoff had that, the huge Ponzi scheme blew up and exposed, you know, a very large swath of very successful Jewish people, they've kind of left that subject alone. They really didn't get into it. Because, again, it's kind of like the most politically incorrect type of topic that you can have. So they haven't embraced the book. But the black community has definitely embraced the book because they see that the seven keys are something that could be emulated and can be learned.
Now, here is where the concept of portability and mobility come together. And I'm going to try to ask you a sharp point, but I'll layer it. Now,
sure.
my mother, she grew up in Brooklyn, Jewish and black neighborhood mix, et cetera. There was a certain relationship between the landlords and the tenants. And some of what Russell Simmons mentioned as he related to the Syrian Jews who had bought up certain stores in the inner city. A lot of the clothing and fashion clothes are owned by Syrian Jews is what Russell's explaining. Okay. Now, by nature, correct me if I'm wrong, but most assessments are that the Jewish religion is non-evangelical, meaning it is not based upon widening the circle and recruiting individuals who are not necessarily immediately born into that circle. Is that correct in general?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay, now that's maybe...
We don't need any extra people. We're not recruiting extra people. We're not going to kill anybody to convert other people into
right.
the religion. Any of that. That's not our business.
Okay, so the other major monotheistic religions, Islam and Christianity, are clearly more evangelical in that respect. Now,
well, they're triumphant religions. But what that means is that if Muhammad is the savior, then that means Jesus isn't. And if Jesus is, then Muhammad isn't. So one has to ultimately triumph over the other. And that's been the point of friction of these religions, is that one believes that they are right, and therefore the other ones are definitely wrong.
Okay, now let me jump in and bring it back a little bit to say that you're right in the sense of triumphant, and that's, you know, missionaries, conquering comes from that. Now, but on the other hand, while the Jewish religion, we wouldn't necessarily call it triumphant in that same way, its exclusivity denies other people perhaps the benefits that it has. So this is why I wanted to ask you the question. That exclusivity, the prohibitions on intermarriage, the private nature, and then the tension that's existed between this minority population and majority countries, do you think that perhaps it has led people to believe that Jews are elite or feel they're better and would not want to give to others what they have enjoyed in the face of the poverty of others? So, for instance, if you're a Jewish... And I'm not just saying Jewish. If you're let me give you an example. My mother is born in Panama, raised in Jamaica, okay? So one of the things that perplexes black Americans, but it doesn't perplex me because of my mother, is some of us don't understand why there's tension between the Caribbean, West Indian blacks and those that are black American. A lot of it has to do with the way in which we've been upbringing, our traditions, etc. There were certain things that black Americans were stripped of that the Caribbean culture was not. Same with Africans. Okay, so when I say exclusivity, I could apply this to the Chinese population or the Caribbean or West African or Indian as well, okay? But to the degree that the Jewish community has gotten intimate knowledge of black people through association, etc., there's a belief or there's a lament that the economic knowledge has not been transferred as much as charity or political. Would you say that that's pretty much just incidental, or do you believe that some have been exploitative and not sharing that knowledge maybe as freely as you are in your book?
I don't think the knowledge of the value of education has been held back from anybody. Of running your own business, I think there's a real cultural barrier to adopting these seven keys. And it's not, I think it's self-imposed.